Hello and welcome to Keanu Club. Like a cool breeze over the mountains, this is episode 18, American Playhouse Life Underwater from 1989. I'm Mike Manzi.
And I'm Joey Lewandowski, and with us, one of our very special guests, Zach Dazon. Hello, Zach.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I can't complain.
So this was, I was going to say this movie, but it's not even a movie. So American Playhouse, according to Wikipedia, American Playhouse was an anthology television series periodically broadcast by PBS in the United States. This TV show was something that I had never heard of before we started doing Keanu Club, and this was one that I don't think you picked originally, but you had some last-minute conflict on a previous one, so we sort of threw you into this one, I think.
Yeah.
Had you ever heard of American Playhouse before we started doing this?
No, but I kind of instinctively understood what it was, so maybe somewhere in my psyche I had heard of it.
It's basically, from what I gather, either like playwrights or other people adapt plays. The screenplay for this is written by the guy who wrote the play this is based on, and he adapted it for what amounts to be an hour worth of television.
Well, the thing that I noticed mostly that I was taking notes about was just like, it does very clearly read like an adapted play. The way they talk is very pattery.
Oh my God.
It's very, mm-hmm. it's a little bit stilted in a way that often straight plays are on stage and reads very well in the theater, but not necessarily on film.
Yeah, I had the exact same note.
Yeah, and there are also little things that you notice, like, oh, in a play, like, they will always reference the children, but never, like, they show them, like, far off in the distance, and, like, they'll use this children as an excuse to leave the scene, but they'll never actually be, like, a major part of it, which is totally, like, a thing that would happen in the theater.
Well, because, like, there's really only about, I would say, three sets, maybe, in this entire hour. There's the restaurant. There is the mom's house, and then there's, like, this beach house. And that's pretty much it. I mean, there's some variations within them, but it's as pretty much as streamlined a TV show as can possibly be, unless you go to the extent of, like, a bottle episode or something.
And my guess is that's probably them complicating it even further, because on stage I feel like a lot of this action could just happen mm-hmm. on, like, two halves of a mostly blank stage. It feels almost Beckett-ish in that respect.
Yeah, it's very minimal. They get by in this movie with the absolute minimum that they need, and they do get by, but you're right, it almost feels like this entire play could take place on the beach, that we don't even need to go indoors at times, even though
right.
we do.
Yeah, it's more just about their interpersonal relationships than anything.
And what's kind of interesting, I messaged Mike while I was watching this, and I said this is weird in kind of a good way, and then by the end of it, I sort of had changed my mind that, like, I'm not really a fan of this. Mm-hmm. It's interesting enough, like, the idea of what American Playhouse is interesting to me. Like, I think that there's probably some other episodes of the show that I would really, really enjoy.
Yeah.
So this one was written by Richard Greenberg, who apparently has more than 25 plays to his name. This was his second play that he wrote. I think he wrote it in, like, 86-ish, and then adapted it a couple years later for this. I just don't think this is very interesting. It's apparently, this guy is known for the malaise of the middle class, and just, you know, mm-hmm. he writes these, like, quote-unquote funny things about the problems that the middle class have.
Yeah.
And it's just all basically, like, first-world problems, the play, and it's just, like, I don't care about anything going on here.
Yeah, he's very Jonathan Franzen-esque like that.
I got kind of like a pretentiousness off of this material that rubbed me a little bit of the wrong way. I almost feel like I would have enjoyed it more if I saw it on stage than the way that it came out on video. It's just a lot of loafing about, doing a lot of nothing, and trying to find my way in the world and what I really stand for. And I think that's kind of something this was going for, but I'm not even entirely sure by the end of this what exactly is going on.
Well, certain actors seem to have a better time with the stiltedness of the language than Keanu, for sure. He was definitely struggling.
I must have walked 20 miles. I kept looking for a refuge. I recognized every house, everybody in every house. They were all members of the club.
Which club?
Whichever. I don't know you.
I'm visiting.
Good. Nice. Oh, God, I'm in no condition to face what I have to face.
What's that?
Poverty. I'm penniless, and I'm trying to make it to the city. Do you have work?
That depends.
I'll do anything. I'll mow your lawn.
There is no lawn.
Why can't you just go home and get money?
Never. I can't even go in the vicinity of that place again. I'm not very resourceful. This was a whim, and I've got to stick to it or I'm dead. Dead. Finished.
I don't want to make fun of this too much because I think it's sort of the point why they're named this.
Right.
But, you know, at the end of the movie, when Keanu's talking to his mom about these two girls that he met, I can't tell you their names. You'll laugh at me. And we find out that they're Amy Joy and Amy Beth,
yeah.
Which is the worst. But I think that the two of them work really well in this world. Mm, it sort of feels like I haven't watched a lot of Sex and the City, but it feels like this is sort of Sex and the City. It's sort of that kind of vibe, at least really early on in the movie, where instead of talking about like men and sex, they're just talking about like escaping their problems in the Hamptons.
Well, I think we should mention that one of the girls in this play is Sarah Jessica Parker. From Sex and the City. I don't think we mentioned
right,
that,
which makes
it even doubly as much Sex and the City.
I sort of meant to bring up that point. Like, that was the whole reason I referenced Sex and the City. But like, it sort of seems like Carrie Bradshaw, a younger Carrie Bradshaw, just up in the Hamptons dealing with some kind of mental issue, I guess?
Yeah, she got into self-mutilation from some sort of self-loathing.
Jesus.
Yeah.
That's something about this. The structure of this play that I didn't quite like was how information is sort of revealed, especially about her character. They play it extremely coy and close to the vest. It's sort of like a struggle, and it's Keanu's mission to sort of understand why Sarah Jessica Parker is acting the way she is and why her friend is someone who's just kind of like mean-spirited, but like a really good friend to Sarah Jessica Parker, even though she's not a very good person. I don't know. I didn't really think that it should have been such a mystery. Maybe we've been watching a lot of this after school special Lifetime type stuff that I was like, okay, yeah, she's clearly disturbed. She just left like a mental ward. So that's all I really needed to know. And I got that immediately. I just felt like it's a level that the movie didn't need to try and go for. It was kind of obvious to us.
Well, to me, it just kind of got revealed a little too early. Like once that happened, like the rest of the play, movie, whatever, I was kind of like, all right, now what?
Yeah, I can see both of your points. I think that is sort of the thing that they're building toward, but also at the same time, I don't really care. And maybe like we're supposed to care. Like doing this kind of podcast puts me in a weird headspace where like I really only care about what Keanu's doing, even though I'm supposed to care about Sarah Jessica Parker. Mm. Like she's the star of this. She's the one at the emotional center. But at the same time, I don't know, because like it's really the only interesting thing going on, because the mom's relationship with her lover or whatever, like that is the worst thing I think we've seen maybe in anything that we've done in Keanu Club so far. Like, I don't know what they're doing. I don't care what they're doing. It's just all around awful.
Yeah,
that was, I got another Prince of Pennsylvania flashback with the mom having the affair, and the guy bothered me because he looked so much like Peter Weller, but it wasn't RoboCop. And every time he came up on screen, I couldn't disassociate him with Peter Weller, so I just kept calling him not RoboCop the whole movie. But I kind of hated that stuff.
They were supposed to be like the epitome of obnoxious upper crustiness. That whole thing about tea roses was so obnoxious, but kind of in a good way.
Yeah, and the one thing about that guy that I was like, okay, he's clearly going through this midlife crisis. He's got a red sports car. He's doing one-arm push-ups. I'm like, he thinks he's Nick Cage or something. What is up with him?
If you want to talk about Nick Cage, something I got from this was that from Keanu's performance is that he seems to be in some ways the anti-Nick Cage. At least at this point in his career, he is choosing the most obvious choice for every line and does not dig any deeper.
What's interesting about the difference between Keanu and Cage is that I think that they're both looked at by the mainstream public as being quote-unquote bad actors, but I think Cage is just misunderstood. I think a lot of this early Keanu stuff, I don't think he's necessarily bad. I think that he's just in these things, the work around him is bad. He's been making these weird career decisions, and maybe it's just, you know, the struggles of a young actor trying to work his way into mainstream acceptance, but like, I don't think anybody here could really give a great performance. I don't really want to give Keanu too much of a break here, but like, what is his role? His role is to sort of be like this aimless, angsty guy who draws information out of Sarah Jessica Parker and who kind of says, "Mom, what you're doing isn't cool." Like, what else? Like, there's nothing else about the character. Like, that's it. Like, that's the entire thing he's doing.
It's true. I feel like the script mainly shines when the characters are on the same page. The two girls bantering back and forth, the wife and her lover when they're kind of on the same page. That's when I was most interested in. Keanu is kind of unmoored from everybody. So that does kind of give him an uphill battle.
there's not a lot here for him to stretch for. I feel like he's playing it fine, but you're right. He's not really putting any real spin on it. I do still feel like he's doing it better than most people might. And I think it helps that he's actually on the beach in this movie because it kind of helps out with his accent a little more, you know, that sort of surfy kind of voice that he's got going on.
I'm struggling to come up with ways to describe things in here just because he's just reflective. Like, there's nothing to his character. We see him, the first time we see him, he's laying on his bed, and his dad is calling long distance from Indianapolis at a time when long distance calls were expensive. He's like, I don't care. I don't want to talk to him. Life is meaningless. He's just a phony. I don't care how much my dad netted last year. And then he just sort of, like, mopes around. He mopes down on the beach, passes out on the beach, mopes around. Like, the most energy he has at any point in this show is maybe doing chores around the house, or what I think we could probably do as a segment for all these things that we can only find on YouTube, like the part of the TV show where it's too dark to figure out what's going on, like when he goes swimming at the end of it. There's nothing else that he does. He's just sort of there laying around, and it's just boring to watch.
Yeah,
it's strange, too, because he kind of wanders into the story of the other girls. It seems like Sarah Jessica Parker and her friend, who, by the way, I only recognize from Gremlins 2. She's the redhead executive girl in that movie. Only other place I've ever seen her. But it kind of seems like they're having a movie, and they kind of just find Keanu on the beach, and he comes, like, wanders into their story. It feels weird because then it's just like, well, Keanu likes Sarah Jessica Parker more, even though he feels like it's easier to score with the redhead. And it almost becomes like, can he score with Sarah Jessica Parker? And eventually he does and sort of helps bring her out of her shell. And then he's gone again, almost kind of magically. So I think it might have helped if we had a little more Keanu dealing with his issues on his own, or maybe bringing more of his issues to the table when he meets the girls, because it just seems like they're the focus mostly of the story.
They're absolutely the focus, but, like, I think this is where it sort of struggles from by being an adaptation of a play, because the guy wants to remain true to his vision of the stage. But, like, what does the impact of the mother have on these girls at all? Like, I'd rather have this be like a half hour or, you know, like two separate things almost. The way that everything's sort of together, it doesn't fit within the tone of this, I don't think.
I mean, I kind of feel like it was meant as something of just a series of vignettes, like just connected by that common thread. Unfortunately, Keanu has to play the role of that thread, which is awkward.
The only thing I could really stretch for is that it's the whole time it's Keanu dealing with women. So first he lives with his single mother, and he's sort of like, who are you going out with tonight? Are you doing it? All that kind of stuff. And then he gets involved with these teenage girls or girls closer to his age. And you see that he wants to be more of the compassionate type of guy that is nice to women as opposed to the jerk that his dad is and the jerk that's dating his mom. So I think if I had to stretch for any kind of connection, it might be that.
Sorry, I got distracted. I realized I've photographed Richard Greenberg before.
Yeah,
he did an adaptation of Far From Heaven into a musical at Playwrights Horizons a few years ago, so I photographed him for that. I mean, I don't know. He's definitely like a theater guy. If this is a play about distancing and alienation from society, from what it means to be human and to struggle, there's a term in theater called the Verstrom-Dunks effect, the alienation.
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a Bertolt Brecht thing. And I feel like he's drawing upon this. The idea being in these plays to actually distance the audience from the play, to make them realize they're watching a play. And I feel like this play was written in that style. Like, that's why everyone talks so weird. And I think it just doesn't translate to film. I just think that's the main issue here.
Yeah, I think you're right. The trick with adaptation is straying from the source material. A book is different than a film, is different than a stage play, and you sort of have to tweak them each to fit into that medium. And it's tough when you want to be like completely faithful to the material. You know, you kind of force it into the medium where it doesn't belong in a way. And I kind of get that. I do get that feeling here, right? Like I mentioned earlier, I think the way it's presented here would work much better. Like the speaking and like, I think that would work fine on a stage, but yeah, it just doesn't feel natural in front of a camera like this on a beach. You know, they're in these natural settings, but they feel very artificial.
Which can be really nice on stage.
And I can understand that being a style, you know, of translation too, but it takes me out of it a little too much. You know, I would much rather feel like I'm just watching a story than watching a play being adapted to video.
Yeah.
What's interesting about it is that when it begins, I think, there's like this sort of kinetic energy about the way that they talk. And like, it sort of catches you off guard because it's not like what you see in TV or movies. And then once you're sort of settled into it, the appeal or like the sort of the novelty of it wears off. Mm-hmm. And you're just like, oh, like this is just where we're going to be for the next hour. Because there is like an excitement. And I think, you know, as I talked about or as we talked about a little bit earlier, the part that works the best is when the girls are together before they meet up with Keanu. And they're just sort of back and forth. And it's this real quick sort of repartee. And like, that's like a great way, I think, to start this out. And then maybe it's the fact that the patter wears off or that it just sort of the energy is not like that for the rest of it. It's never as good as it is in the first couple minutes.
So tell me.
Oh, you'll die. I am bad.
I'm so bad.
What did you do?
Oh, you'll just die.
What if I don't?
I'll be very disappointed. But it's not gonna happen. It's just not gonna.
You went out to allay your fears.
I went out because the little one, the girl.
Mm-hmm, I know who you mean.
Isolde. Hell, what kind of people name the kids Tristan and Isolde and the dogs Brian and Susan? I mean...
Your uncle.
Uncle Andre. Andre Weingrad, as in Abe Weingarten. I mean, the whole family.
So you went out to allay her fears?
Because she thinks she sees the sea monster. I find out. I go there. I find out. The other kid.
Tristan and Susan.
Tristan, you believe that? Name like that, he's going to have serious trouble dating.
Yeah, and I think it might be because the story isn't as heavy at that point, right? Like, everything's just lighter all around. We haven't gotten into the deep subject matter yet. Once they start talking about why Sarah Jessica Parker went to the asylum or, you know, how long they've been friends and who's really good for who, it really kind of slows down and I do feel like you start to notice more like things just aren't really clicking. And I do agree that it does start with this energy that it kind of just, it just can't sustain it.
How old is Keanu meant to be?
I feel like he's probably college age.
But he didn't go to college because he didn't need to because he's rich.
It also feels like the summer. Like, is it the summer? I feel like this is sort of maybe like end of summer, like, you know, transition time. Or like
Indian
everything.
Summer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because they say at the end when they're sitting on the stoop, like, you know, oh, it's getting a little bit colder now. I feel like it's sort of just meant to be like that time of the year when things change or what have you.
Yeah, I was endlessly distracted by how old he was supposed to be because he was acting like a 16-year-old, but like they were into him and they seemed to be older. Were they older than him or just more experienced?
That's a good question. I don't know.
Yeah, they all seem to be pretty close to each other's age for me, which was like college age, which was between, you know, like 18 and 21. That's kind of the vibe that I got off of all the people in here. But he's definitely kind of experienced. His mom mentioned something about some singer, some hippie or some folk singer that he slept with, you know, so he's had Miss McGill's tea before, and I believe he has it during this movie off screen at some point as well.
Yeah.
My favorite part of the, like, it's so stupid, but like, I just love how like Sarah Jessica Parker calls him out on this, but like my favorite part is when Keanu tries to pick her up by basically just quoting The Great Gatsby and like trying to make it seem like this is his life. And she's like, no, like immediately, like no time wasted at all. She's like, no, I've read too. Like, I know that's Great Gatsby. Basically, get out of my face.
Do you know, before I came here, I used to gaze up at this house. I used to wonder about it. There's a green light that burns all night at the end of your dock.
That's the goddamn Great Gatsby. I can read. Oh, you sensitive boys with your quotations. I don't trust you as far as I can throw you.
Well, there's like several of those elements. They remind you of like the existence of literature and plays and things. And that I feel like that once again is this Brechtian thing. They're like actually trying to draw you out of the play. They're actively trying to get you to snap out of it and realize that you're watching a play. Yeah. So like naming the kids Tristan and Isolde, then immediately mentioning that they're named Tristan and Isolde. Isn't that hilarious and weird? Naming both of the ladies Amy and then making a joke about it. Yeah, doing this, it seems very metatextual.
Yeah, the one time I thought it actually worked kind of nice and was really informative was when they first get to the beach and throw down their reading material, and one of them's got like a Vogue and the other's got this thick novel, you know? So you immediately got like, this one's shallow and this one's deep.
So the whole dynamic of their relationship is that, we talked about it earlier, is that Keanu, not hooks up with, but like gets with these girls. He sort of collapses on the beach in front of them and Amy Joy, who's the redhead, not Sarah Jessica Parker. Okay, so Sarah Jessica Parker, and it's not Sarah Jessica Parker. So not Sarah Jessica Parker seems to, like, this is her family house, I think, right? Like, it's her family's place or whatever.
No, it's not Sarah Jessica Parker's aunt and uncle's house, and she's babysitting the kids while they're out in Paris.
Okay, cool. So she invites Keanu in to stay because this is her family home or her aunt and uncle's home, and she has the choice. And so then, as we talked about earlier, Keanu chooses to go Sarah Jessica Parker instead of the other one because he's more attracted to Sarah Jessica Parker, whatever. Things happen. They all go on their separate way. Then at the end of the hour, Keanu is sitting on the front stoop with his mom, and she's like, oh, I saw that, you know, I saw those two girls or whatever that you were talking about. One of them was really pretty. Is that the one that you were with? And he says, no, the other one. And I'm just like, that's so mean.
I caught a glimpse of them when I picked you up. One of them looked very pretty.
No, it was the other one.
Oh.
Because, I mean, I think that, you know, Sarah Jessica Parker has a lot of jokes that we don't need to talk about on this podcast about her appearance or whatever. I think she's cute in this movie or this TV show.
Oh, yeah.
And just to say, like, oh, no, it's I was with the ugly one, not the cute one. It's just, like, so blunt and out of nowhere. And I don't know if that's meant to be a dig or meant to be a joke or just supposedly the natural way that he talks about it, but it just came off so jarringly.
I feel like it might have been an acting decision. I think a good actor could have better conveyed the idea that he understands that most people prefer the other one and that he just kind of is resentful of his mother for not understanding, implicitly not understanding that the one he likes is the prettier one.
Yeah, I agree. And I also feel like if they wanted to have like an ugly character, they should have hired an ugly actress, because Sarah Jessica Parker is attractive in this film, you know, but the character isn't supposed to be, right? Like, we learn that she clawed part of her face off and had needed plastic surgery and all kinds of reconstruction. And I feel like if we had just seen some of that, you know, a scar or something, a bandage, but instead she looks really cute and pretty. And her friend is also very attractive. And it's like, yeah, this is a dilemma for Keanu, you know, a guy who can have whoever he wants. Now he needs to choose. I think if the story did a better job of explaining that she's supposed to be not as good looking, then that line might have worked a lot better. But I was also taken aback. I was like, whoa.
And what's happening, like, she's with this guy. And the guy, I think, like, Keanu isn't great at delivering the lines of this play. But at the same time, I think that the guy that she's with is even worse at it, that he just sounds like he's speaking like a playwright the entire time. It just doesn't work at all. Like, aside from the fact that I don't know why he's there, really, or like his character, or care about it, I just don't think he's doing a good job. But aside from all of that, he leaves at the end of the summer, I guess this sort of was just like a summer fling, and then the mom is just sitting on the stoop at the end, and Keanu's like, why'd he send you a picture of a bunch of men? And it's just like I think that's another one that's like Zach saying. It's just the line reading of that is just so weird. There's got to be some deeper reason. Like, you know, she's like, oh, it's like something that they talked about or whatever. But just the way that he asks a question is just like, oh, like, this is weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some story behind that picture, right? There's like a significance, something about them. They're all gigolos now or something, right? I think that's what I got from it. So it was sort of like also supposed to be this inside joke between her and the guy she was having an affair with. Like, oh, I'm not around anymore, but here's a bunch of guys. Like, maybe you could call one of them instead. And it almost, to me, felt like this dig against the mother, and she's realizing, yeah, that guy was an asshole, and I'm glad he's gone now, and maybe I just need to spend some more quality time with my son, who's an actual nice man, and I can raise him to be the kind of guy that respects women.
Or at the very least, she spends time with her son, who speaks more quickly than everybody else around. Like, that's like the one thing that she misses. Like, when he comes back, I guess, to pick up some clothes or whatever, she's just like, everyone around here just speaks so slowly. Like, I've missed you. And just like, okay, like, that's your problem? It's that people talk too slowly?
Well, you know what's crazy, too, is how the passage of time is conveyed in this movie. It feels like Keanu's gone for one night, and they're like, you've been here 5 days. And I was like, what? 5 days? And then he goes home, and she's like, where have you been for a week? I'm like, what is going on? They're in some kind of time warp. Like, this whole thing takes place over the course of the entire summer, I think. I could be wrong, but judging by how people in the movie tell time, hours or days, it's just really crazy.
I think we're missing a few lights down, lights up moments.
Yeah.
or just like any kind of moments. Like, this is the thing, I feel like this is just like an awkward amount of time, like an hour. If it was half an hour and you sort of just picked one or the other, I think it would work better. I think it was a full 2 hours. Not that I would necessarily want to see a full 2 hour version of this, but if it was a full 2 hours, I think that would have worked better too. It's just as it stands now, it's this awkward middle ground where like you have enough time to tell part of a story, but not enough of a story that makes the rest of it make sense.
It almost feels like story is kind of coming secondary. It's more about kids dealing with emotions that they're not ready for in a way, or just these three different young adults, their different outlooks on the world, and are they going to change, and what is their future going to be like? So like halfway through this, I didn't really expect any narrative conclusion, but I knew that there was going to be emotional growth and character changing like that. And I think that you get that much more with this type of material.
I think that's all I have to say about it. I mean, I don't really have anything else. It sort of teases that it could be visually interesting, but it's not. It was directed by a guy who never directed anything else, I think, in his entire career. I think he produced this and like one other episode of American Playhouse. And the guy who wrote this, who wrote the screenplay for this and wrote the play it was based on, also wrote another episode of American Playhouse. So like, I guess this was like a great platform, maybe, for playwrights to get their work out to like a broader audience, maybe outside of New York.
I think I read a few things about this that suggested that.
It kind of reminds me of when I go to the movies now and I see the ads for Fathom events, and you know, you could go to the theater and watch the opera. And so it kind of seems like back when they were making these, it's like for people who can't get exposed to theater and plays and don't live in major cities, we'll make this video series for them and they can pick them up at their local library and maybe get a little culture that way. I had one more note. I remember after we did the One Step Away episode, we sort of had some questions about the funding for that, how it was funded by the country of Canada, basically. And we got some literature from Lindsay Gibb about how Canada's Film Board funds a lot of the arts and things like that. And for this movie, I actually was able to get a VHS copy off eBay for a couple bucks from the Los Angeles Public Library. And at the beginning of it, it shows sort of all the sponsors who put up the funding for this. And you have PBS, you have the Corporation for Public Broadcast, you have National Endowment for the Arts, and then you also have the Chubb Insurance Group. And I just remember the Chubb Institute. I remember hearing about them a lot growing up. And so I almost feel like this is, in a way, how America arts get funded as opposed to like other countries. You know, we don't really get money from the government, but we get like these special interest groups that are able to fund productions like this.
The presentation of American Playhouse is made possible by the nation's public television stations, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and by the Chubb Group of Insurance Companies. For over 100 years, providing business and personal insurance worldwide through independent agents and brokers.
Because Canada seems to really care about the art that they put out, and they sort of want their country to be known for this. And we're just like I feel, you know, nobody makes more TV or movies than America. And we're just like, oh, just figure it out on yourself. Like, we can't be bothered to give you money. Like, just either go through the system or find your own money.
Yeah.
Yeah, but it would be incredible if there was like government mandated funding for the arts and stuff. And then, you know, maybe we could have gotten an hour and a half of this instead of an hour.
Well, you know, if we do get extra funding for something, let's not spend the money on this. Like, let's go somewhere else. Let's get something else to be a little bit more creatively fulfilled. Zach, anything else about American Playhouse Life Underwater that you wanted to talk about?
Nothing I can think of.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. You will be back in just a couple episodes for, I think, another quick one. This is one of our, like, Keanu's been in a bunch of movies lately. Early in his career, we're doing these shorter podcast episodes. This one's not too long, but the next one will be even shorter for just one sketch on the Tracy Ullman Show. So we'll see you soon, Zach. For all things Keanu Club, you can go to cageclub.me or facebook.com/cageclub. Find all the episodes that we've done. You can figure out what's coming next. All sorts of podcasting needs at cageclub.me and facebook.com/cageclub. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Zach Dazon, and we'll see you next time on Keanu Club.